Hello and welcome to this episode of the ESG Fitness Podcast. I have Ruth and Maureen with me. Ruth, how are you?
I'm good, thank you. I'm not on holiday like Maureen, but got the kids home on school days, but it's nice. Yeah. I
Your hair looks very nice today.
think that's post gym.
Do you know what? I do think
Imagine.
that like a bit of sweat, like when you first wash your hair, it doesn't look good. And then like 2 days in, you're like, oh, optimal level of grease here. And then it goes downhill again.
I also have actually a couple of people said your hair looks really nice. I'm like, I actually dried it rather than just leave it, which is what I normally do. I'm like, oh, that bodes well. It's actually that I have done some form of self-care on hair.
Damn it. Everyone will be quite surprised by this, but actual GHD sent me some hair straighteners.
You.
Yeah, I know. They were like, I got an email being like, oh, do you want, normally it's just spam. I don't actually really know why I opened that one, but I did. And they were like, do you want us to send you these hair straighteners that like dry your hair while it straightens? And I was like, why not? You know, like I'll probably never use them, but why not? And actually I do use them. And they're very good because you can just use them with like quite wet hair. Yeah.
They, yeah, Maureen, did Emma freeze then? Or was it me?
No, I
Oh.
think everyone just took a bit of a dramatic pause.
Okay.
It was very shocking revelation.
Yeah. Because Emma's dry. Well, there you go. So I'm glad you got those. That's good.
Oh, also, I'd just like to report that it's been, I'd say at least like 8 months since I got the knot cut out of my hair. And no new one has appeared. Now, whether that's because I've been brushing my hair more, or whether it's because there is now no hair to knot because it was cut out, who knows? But I'm going to take it as a win.
That's a big win. I think it's due to the brushing.
I think so. I mean, I never look at the back of my head, nor do I often wear my hair down, but I wonder what it would look like if I wore it down, like if it would be obvious that there was just a random like part of really short hair.
A big tumbleweed or the short hair. Yeah. No, it has to be grown by now, like a good bit.
Not half as much as the rest of my head.
Yeah, but you got your hair cut short there the last time.
I know, it was such a bad idea.
Yeah, but that other bit must be catching up now.
Well, yeah, maybe. Okay, anyway, how are you?
I'm okay. I'm doing a lot of coughing, so if I mute or turn off my camera, it's because I've taken into a fit of coughing.
Okay, fine.
Yeah, apart from that,
Well,
I'm good. I'm good. It's sunny. It's like 20 something, 26 degrees out there.
It's pissing down with rain here and about 8 degrees, so.
Delighted. Fucking delighted.
Yeah, I got very wet today. Yeah.
Not fun.
No, not wet in a good way. It
No.
is
When you're on holiday, though, it is nice to look at the weather forecast back home and be like, good, it's not sunny.
Oh, 100%. Like, otherwise, you're like, why have I spent all this money coming all the way out here and then it's sunny at home?
Yeah. Yeah.
Let's get on with some excellent questions.
Yes. So, first question, I'm just going to summarize a little bit here. So, one of our lovely members used to go and have blood taken when she had ME, and they found it really, really hard to take blood. And she went in the other day to have bloods taken, now easy to take the blood. So, her question is there a reason why it might have been harder before, and why now her health has improved it and she's more active and so on? That it's not so hard anymore. I believe that's the summarizing.
There are loads of things that could potentially be. I think more blood flow, a stronger heart pump potentially might benefit there. I also don't know. The ME is quite an interesting condition because it can be manifested, or you can have different symptoms for different people, and it's quite an overarching diagnosis of like some kind of fatigue that we're not really quite sure exactly what the cause is. So there could be like numerous things going on. And then what's quite interesting as well is that when you're very overweight, it's hard to find a vein and to get blood. But also when you're very lean, it can be, as much as you can see the vein, they can kind of like move quite a lot and that can make it quite hard to get blood as well. The other thing is some nurses are just really good and others just like aren't that good. So sometimes it's like practitioner or phlebotomist, should I say, but sometimes it is like the skill of the practitioner. And then a really weird thing that happens with my veins, and I think it's because I've got Raynaud's, but I also just came up with that hypothesis myself, so it could literally be anything. But if someone gets my vein first time, no problem, like not an issue. If they don't get it first time, it's like it shuts and that, like, you will not get blood from me.
I've heard that before, but I thought that was to do with like a constriction, like a stress response. But
yeah, like they say constriction. I'm quite chill because like I am also a trained phlebotomist. If you didn't know, yeah. So when I was doing that training, a lot of people tested on me or like practiced on me. So you kind of practice on each other and stuff. Like when I was doing my PhD. So I, you know, any fear that I had of needles is kind of like, well, a lot of people have tried. Although I will say that one of the worst experiences was, and I had to stop the girl because I was like, she was like, you normally feel for where you think it is, right? And then you're like, right, okay, I'm about to go. Okay, yeah, that's where it is. And I was like, that is my tendon. Like, that is not a vein. But she could obviously feel something. And like, you can feel my tendons, right? And she was like, oh yeah, that's a big juice. I'll definitely go. And I was thinking, no. I was like, surely she's going to notice before she just started getting the needle out. I was like, no. Yeah.
No. Crunchy. But mine are quite easy.
Really good when you get, when you start getting good at it. So satisfying.
Do you know, it's not something I've had to do. I'd be worried about going in too far.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Some people do. They're really not very gentle. Yeah.
Just be a bit slapdash, get this done.
Actually, go right through the vein and then
somebody has commented saying that they take blood for a living, and she said, I say healthier the more hydrated and active you are does help, which is kind of summarizing what you said anyway.
That's a really good point as well though, like a lot of just day-to-day changes in like hydration levels and things, and like have you had anything to eat, like that kind of stuff, that can make quite a big difference as well. But it is funny because a lot of, whenever I go in, like a nurse will be like, oh yeah, that'll be really easy because you can see your veins. And I'm like, just have a little try. You try before you think it's that easy. Yeah. Anyway.
What about you, Maureen? Are you easy to take blood from?
I don't know. I think it's down to the person. I remember like when I had to go for my gastroscopy and I was finding out I was celiac, the nurses like could not like get the thing, whatever that's called, cannula into my arm. Like, and they had me teared to bits, and then the consultant came in and he managed to do it. But I think I'm generally okay. I don't know.
There you go.
It definitely is down to the person. I think that's a big factor. Like,
yeah. Definitely.
We've got one from Emma next. What is your opinion? The best bang for your buck, cow's protein meal. What is your go-to evening meal when you don't have much time? Ah, okay.
Well, we all know mine, stuff, yeah. Right?
Yeah. With whatever you have just thrown in.
Yeah, with not stir fry ingredients, but just whatever thrown into a wok, and the wok is what makes it the stir fry.
Like spaghetti and eggs.
Yeah, I've been having a lot of eggs in it. Yeah. What about you, Maureen?
My go-to is like literally just mince into a pan, a load of veg, and either like a baked potato or baby potatoes or pasta. Yeah, with cheese.
That sounds good. Yeah, mine would be if I'm going best, like bang for your buck, and you're just getting as much, you want to get veg, protein, and everything in. Then I will do a pasta dish with some chicken, if that's what I've got in, and then I would put a bit of cream cheese, loads of veg in here. I'm talking like frozen broccoli would just go in, everything goes in, and serve it with pasta. So like a little bit like an Alfredo, but with a bit of cream cheese instead. That would be my quick thing. Or stir fry, because I think you can buy the pre-cut stir fry veg and it's ready to go. Also a tray bake. I mean, yeah. I like quick, easy meals.
The tuna and sweet corn. Tuna and sweet corn on a potato or in pasta. Delish.
That just reminds me of being a student. I think I had that every single night.
Oh, so good though.
Yeah. Yeah. It was very good. Has anyone tried? So a company sent me the other day, skinny rice.
No, like it just sounds rank. Why? Is it nice?
It is vile. Like, it, do you know what it kind of reminds me of? Although I say it reminds me of this, but I've never actually had this. You know, bubble tea, and it's got like the little bubbles in it, or whatever they are made out of, like juicy little things. That's what the rice reminds me of, and it doesn't taste of anything. And that's, so I Googled what it was. It's called like Kojak or Cognac or Kojak, I don't know, something. But it doesn't, like, it's kind of just, like, weird. The texture is very strange as well. Kind of slimy stuff that doesn't taste of anything. But I guess if you wanted to bulk out meals, now, before anyone runs out and buys this, I actually don't know how nutritionally, like, sound it would be to have a lot of it. It kind of tastes a bit chemically. But there's only 14 calories in, like, a whole thing. Anyway, it ruined my stir fry the other night. And it just, it's very wet. Not what
but they're
you want.
Glad they sent it to you.
Well, I haven't named the company. Yeah.
No, not so nice.
Would it not just be better if you're gonna, if you want a rice alternative, like as in you're bulking out a meal, then go back, go down the old like cauliflower rice or something like that instead, which it,
or just have like, if you're like,
or
okay,
just veg.
I'm gonna have a stir fry. And you're like, oh, I kind of want some rice with it. Yeah, you could have cauliflower rice, or you could just have like more veg, like any veg.
We'll just have some rice.
How dare you, Ruth?
Radical.
I used to use the cauliflower rice a lot, but I've heard of somebody putting it in their porridge. Like, how disgusting is that? He was like, it doesn't taste of anything, and it's similar kind of consistency to porridge. I'm like, you are just septic.
I'm sorry, but cauliflower does taste of something. And that is a little bit like a foot.
The smell, yeah. It's the smell and the texture. It's not, it smells as well different, doesn't it? It's not the same.
Yeah,
as
when you cut open that bag, it's...
Yeah.
And you know what? You probably could put this skinny rice thing in porridge. It just kind of tastes like nothing.
It's baby rice pudding.
Yeah, I quite like rice pudding with actual rice, you know.
Same.
Can I
next
continue
question?
Oh yeah. I'm sorry, did someone have a Kinder egg?
Yeah, I did. Yes, what last night
toy?
what was
what was the toy?
Oh, it's a little bear, I think.
Did you manage to make it all on your own?
I did. Like, I need a medal. No, I didn't. Oh my God, I can't put it together.
Oh gosh, this is...
It's broken. Bad. It won't click in. I can't do it.
I say, Kinder eggs are... Oh, that's very cute. No, where's its... Oh, okay, right.
You see its guts.
Yeah, I had it in earlier, but now it seems to... Oh, there we go.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He was like me when I started the podcast.
Okay, ready?
Yeah, next question. Oh, yeah. Prawn or tofu stir fry? Also love Greek... Oh, no, that's somebody replying to your one. Sorry. Oh, no, it's not.
Yeah, it is.
I think somebody is, but it's just, it's come as a type of questions. Right. What do you and Chloe, your coaches, do for cardio? Let's go with that one first. So what do you do for cardio first, Emma?
I actually don't do a lot at the moment. I just get my steps in, but it is something I think I'm going to bring in a little bit more. Just because I think, actually, do you know why this is? I do this all the time, but I was coming back from London and I was like, oh, okay, I need to be at King's Cross at whatever it was, 10, and it takes 20 minutes to get there, so I'll leave at 20 to 10. And then I was like, oh my God, my train leaves King's Cross at 10. You know, can't just get there at 10. Like, and also the underground is not the same as like where the train leaves and blah, blah, blah. So then I was like, oh, okay, I've really not left enough time. And I was just like dallying around. I was like, oh, I might go buy myself an apple. And then I realized I had to run, right? So then I had to run. And I was like, oh, I'm not very fit. Like I was really out of breath, and not just out of breath, but my throat actually kind of hurt. So then I thought I should probably do a little bit more cardio just for those situations. Yeah.
Isn't it different though? You're always out of breath if you're running for a bus or a train or things. And if you're going for a run, then it's easier.
Yeah, I still think I could work on the cardio. So there's holding myself accountable. I'm going to do a bit more cardio. Although I was on the phone to Maureen the other day and we were testing out how quickly my shitty little treadmill goes. Turns out, quite fast.
Goes pretty fast.
Yeah. You do quite a lot of cardio, Ruth.
Yeah, I guess I do. I mean, yeah, I do. I run minimum twice a week and I try and do 3 times a week. And then I put a bit of cardio at the end of a couple of my gym sessions. So yeah, I do a fair bit. So, but my cardio at the end of the gym session, like today, it was a couple of 500 meter rows and things like that. So just going for what I can. And then,
A hard 500 meter row just reminds me of hard times.
Yeah, it's really tiring. And then I had a time that I was aiming for and I wasn't really feeling it. So it wasn't the best today. And I meant to then go and I was going to do some sled pushes afterwards. But yeah, so I do a bit of cardio at the end of a session and then I go for a run. But my runs, I go for one long run and then the other runs I just try and enjoy. Yesterday, Mycroft pulled me, my dog pulled me around my run on a harness, and that's always my favourite.
What do you normally go for 500 metres? Under 2 minutes?
Yeah, about 150.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done it quicker and then 2 minutes is comfortable, but like 150 is, like today 150 felt hard, but I think I started off and it was like, oh, I'm going 147, that's pretty good. And then I'm like,
what drag factor do you have it on?
130, which is
okay, so you're doing it legit.
Yeah, I'm doing it legit because I was doing it just whacking it up to 10 and going as hard as I could and just muscling it, but I was like, I probably just need to, and that's when my times were probably quicker for shorter distances, right? I could go quicker, but since I've changed it down to now I'm on 6,
yeah, I think, or whatever that equates to. Yeah. Is that because that's what they use for High Rocks and stuff?
No, you can put it on whatever you want at High Rocks.
Oh, right.
You're just not allowed to change it once you set it, so you have to do it the same as your partner. So no, this is just me trying it myself. I did it in the gym when I just checked the drag setting. Yeah. There.
Yeah, because I remember we used to always have to set it to that for rowing because that's apparently what's closest to water. So we'd always have to set your drag factor to 130.
But I think it's meant to be better to get, you'll get better technique if you're doing it like that. And
it's a completely different movement if you just put it up to 10. It's like less cardio-esque and kind of like more strength, I guess. Well, I mean, not quite, but you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Maureen, what do you do? Play football?
I'm not doing any at the minute now because I'm not playing football this year. So I didn't go this year, yeah, because I wanted to have the availability to do what I'm doing now, to go away, because I didn't have that before. So I decided not to go back this year. So I'm not playing football at the minute. I was going on the recumbent bike, which I know you highly rate. I don't see what the issue is. You're still moving your legs. It's just you're in a different position.
Do you actually get out of breath doing that?
No, but that's not the point. I was just doing steady state cardio.
Okay, fine.
I didn't like it on my back.
What I like on the normal bike. I find I just get, if I'm not comfortable, I just get bored and I'm like, I don't want to do this. So if I'm on that recumbent bike, at least I was answering DMs or something and I was pedaling away and I was like, yeah, great. I'll just go now.
Wiping away.
Yeah. Next.
Okay. I love cardio sessions where you can just put on, like, somebody was asking me about doing steps in cardio instead of steps on a check-in. And I was like, you can go and do cardio, you can get on your bike. And they were asking if they should do like a HIIT or whatever. And I was like, if you're just seeing it as general activity, pop on a film, put your headphones on, set it to scenic ride or whatever and enjoy it. Just have some fun.
Yeah, I do think that I guess that's the point, right? When I was like, oh, all I really do is steps, it's more that that's activity. Now, if you're someone who's like, I really struggle to get my steps in, absolutely just do some cardio. Now, and you can, obviously you can do like, quote unquote, proper cardio where you're pushing yourself and you're pushing your heart rate up. Or you can be like, okay, well, you know, I really struggle to get my steps in. And then I get home, and then I can't just leave my like young children to go and get my steps in. So, but I do have an exercise bike. Okay, just put it in front of the TV. Like, that's fine. You're still moving, you're still doing something. There's still a point to it, even if you're like, oh, it's not as hard as what I might have done at another point, or oh, it's not technically steps. It's like, okay, fine. We all live like quite sedentary lifestyles. Like today, I feel like I've been really active. I just looked at my thing and I've only done 8,000 steps. And I'm like, what? How? Like, how is that possible? Right. And yeah, it's just you. My point is, you normally have to go out of your way to be active unless you like have a very active job naturally. And that's me having walked all the way to the gym, walked for 10 minutes on the treadmill, walked back, walked to a coffee shop, and then walked back. And I'm like, how is this still only, you know, I've gone out of my way, even though it's pissing with rain, to be really active, and it's still not very active. So yeah, if that's the situation you're in, and I will probably get the rest of my steps in walking on the treadmill.
Yeah. Maybe yeah. Watching us on your phone still and
me watching. On my phone? Oh, Ruth, no. Yeah. Yeah, almost definitely, yeah. Okay.
This is part two of the questions from your check-ins. Can you talk again about the lose fat first and build muscle versus recomp debate? Some say better do the former as it's quicker and as the latter is a competing tool, so a competing goal for your body. Okay, so.
Okay, I get what they mean. Yeah. I thought you meant, yeah, okay.
No, building, yeah.
The reason this is still a debate is because it depends on the person. Right. If you're someone who normally the people that are worried about this are the last people that should be worried about this. So it's often people that are like, they've got a lot of fat to lose. They've never resistance trained before. And they're like, I'm just worried about, you know, like which one I should do first. Both. You can absolutely build muscle and lose fat. Sometimes I say that the wrong way around. Yeah. Lose fat and build muscle at the same time if you have a lot of fat to lose. 100%. Where you can't do this is when you're very lean. Like it just doesn't work. And certainly not to any extreme. You certainly wouldn't be able to lose more fat and build muscle at the same time. You're probably going to risk losing muscle if you're losing more fat. That's why like when people compete and they get to that level of lean, they do lose muscle. It doesn't look like it because they're kind of revealing more of the muscle because the layer of fat on top is now gone. So they might look like they have more muscle, but they don't. They have less. Like when you compete, you will lose muscle going into a show, unless you're not natural, in which case, hey, maybe you can maintain your muscle, or depending on how much steroids you're taking, potentially you can build your muscle. But for anyone natural, like that really doesn't happen. Like when you get to that level of lean, you are losing muscle. If you're someone who has excess body fat to lose, you can absolutely do both at the same time. And it almost doesn't matter, because we would always train you the same anyway. Like whether the goal is let's maintain your muscle while we lose fat, or let's build muscle while we lose fat, you need to do the same thing to build muscle or to maintain muscle. Like our training would always be geared towards let's try and build muscle. And then the nutritional environment is kind of dictating whether there's a surplus of energy with which to build muscle or there's not, but you're still using it. So you're not going to lose it, right? If the body's like, right, we're in negative energy balance, where are we going to take energy from? And your active tissue, your muscle is being used, then it's like, well, you're using that. We're not going to take that. We're going to take it more primarily from fat. So whether the goal was like, quote, unquote, just fat loss or not, your training would be the same. You still want to stimulate muscle so that you don't lose it.
Yeah. Nothing else to really add there because you just covered it all.
Why, thank you.
Agreed. Shall I carry on?
Yes.
What bit of advice would you have told your younger self? Something that has made a difference to your life? Words of wisdom, perhaps, or a book to read, or a wee mantra?
Do you have one off the top of your head?
I do. I
Yeah.
do. Yeah, just because I thought about this, because this is one from one of my one-to-one check-ins. And for me, it would be that you're not expected to know it all already. I used to be scared of being wrong, and actually now what I've realized, and something I'm definitely trying to instill in my kids, is that not knowing is the bit where you get to learn. It's the fun bit. Like, not knowing is the opportunity to know more. Knowing already doesn't give you any opportunities for growth at all. So that is what I tell younger me, I think.
I love that. And I also love, like, when you're that kind of reminded me of, like, when you're talking to someone, and everyone loves to an extent talking about themselves, right? But, like, that person in front of you, there's something that they know that you don't know. In fact, there's probably loads of stuff that they know that you don't know. And if you kind of make it your mission to find out what it is that they know that you don't know, like, what can you learn from this person? I always think that's quite a nice way to approach it. And I totally agree, like, say that you don't know, or ask people questions. Like, they're not normally as stupid as what people think, and actually some of the most basic questions create really interesting answers. Like, I'm reading this book at the moment called The Alchemist, and it's by a marketing expert, and one of the examples that he gives is, he's like, I asked the question to a train line, like, why don't people like standing on the train? And, like, the obvious answer that most people stop at is, like, well, it's uncomfortable. Like, you want to sit down because you're tired, or, you know, like, it's better to have a seat kind of thing. But when you work through that, and it's like, is it better to have a seat? Do people want to sit down, or are they worried that someone's going to steal something out of their backpack? Or are they worried that because they're on a moving train, they need to, like, hold on to a pole or something, which means they can't use their phone, which means the journey feels longer to them. And then it's like, okay, well, when you've kind of delved into that a little bit more, and it's not necessarily that they're standing, it's actually all the things that come with standing, then you can come up with novel solutions to it, right? When you've got that mind that's like thinking in, like, okay, well, why not? And then why don't people like standing? Or, well, why are they tired? And why don't they want to do that? What are they worried about? All this, then you can come up with, like, okay, well, then could we have places where there'd be, like, you can lean against, like, a side seat, and there's a place to put your backpack so that you're not worried about it being stolen, and you're not, you know, you can use your hands for your phone. And it's like, okay, well, could trains be designed like that? And instead of having more and more and more carriages, so everyone has to sit down, could there be ones where you stand, but you stand in a way that you want to stand, right? Same with, like, another example he uses is, it would cost, like, millions and millions and millions in innovation, if not billions, to make plane journeys twice as fast. But can you make them twice as nice quite easily? And then it's like, okay, well, you know, people, sure, people will say, I just want to get there faster. But they might want to get there faster because the experience isn't enjoyable. Whereas if the experience was much more enjoyable, they're like, okay, I don't care that it takes an extra hour. So I think that kind of stuff. And I was thinking about it in terms of coaching a little bit, and how you can apply that as well. Because even things like waiting times. So again, he does a lot in transport. So it's like, if you just had I don't know, the tube station, the next train is to Clapham, but it doesn't say when it's coming. You're kind of standing there in anxiety, like, okay, well, the next train, but, like, when is the next train, right? Whereas if you know it's coming in 3 minutes, fine. And even if you know it's coming in 15 minutes, fine, because you know when it's coming, right? It's that element. Same with, like, Uber. You can see when it's coming and how long it's going to take, and it almost doesn't matter that it might take 15 minutes longer, because you know it's coming 15 minutes later. And same with, like, what people expect from check-ins. It's like, people wouldn't care if it was a day late if they know when to expect it, you know? Like, hey, it's going to take us 48 hours to get through all of these check-ins, but they will be with you by X time. People don't mind waiting. And in fact, sometimes people, like, want to wait because they know they're going to get a better response from it. Anyway, I just thought all that was quite interesting. It's like, normally, like, the immediate thing would be, like, I don't know, clients might say, I want my check-in feedback within an hour, which is obviously unrealistic, right? But actually they don't. They just want to know when it's coming back and they want a high quality check-in. But they don't want to be left thinking, oh, I don't know if it's coming today or tomorrow or the next day or whatever.
Yeah. And, you know, we say 48 hours. And if it's earlier, hopefully they'll be really happy that it's earlier.
Yeah. Which is exactly what we already do. But anyway, I just thought...
Exactly.
What's your piece of advice, Maureen?
I was just trying to think there. Like, I would probably say to not to be worried about societal norms of doing things. But saying that at the same time, like, I don't have regrets for how I lived my life, because if I changed something, I might not be here now. But at the same time, it's kind of like, was there a lot of pressure put on me from a younger age to do things the way people expected? But it's like, that's not how I want to do things. And people kind of see it as, oh, well, you shouldn't be doing X, Y, Z this way, this the way. You're supposed to grow up. This is what you're supposed to do after school. You're supposed to get a 9-to-5 job, get a permanent position and stay in that job forever. And it's like, I don't want to do that. And I think I was definitely scared of making the jump from leaving my job and becoming self-employed, but I still did it, but it was still scary. So I think, yeah, definitely not to be thinking that you like have to just do what other people expect or how they think you should live your life.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I get what you mean as well, because it's like, actually, would you have changed anything that you did because it got you here? And I feel the same, but would I have felt significantly different about it and not beat myself up so much and probably had a happier time? Yes, you know, like if you hadn't had these expectations put on you. So yeah, I get that. I think mine would be, obviously, I just get obsessed with books as I'm reading them. So I think the last book I read that really kind of was impactful on me was the book Look Again, which is all about gratitude. So I think it would be that, like appreciating what you have. And also just the realization that, like, especially now with social media, everything looks better than it actually is. In fact, I find this hilarious at the moment because I keep getting targeted with reels about Albania. And it's like, I just got one today. I keep sending them to Amelia. Like, this is such false advertising, right? Albania is beautiful, I have to say, right? But Amelia and I went last year and it is not ready, you know? Like, in all of these reels, it just looks like, you know, one of them's like, this is not Thailand. It's like the Albanian Riviera and stuff. And like, if you're smart with Instagram, like, it is genuinely what it looks like. But if you flip the camera, it's like, everything is building site. There are no women anywhere. Like, there's just stray cats like wandering around everywhere. Like it, which is, you know, fine, but it's just funny that you only see one side of things, right? And it's a good example of like almost anything. You look at someone else's life and you're like, oh my God, how perfect is it? Or, oh, they've got no worries, or they've got this, they've got that, they look amazing, they blah, blah, blah. And you just don't see like the flip of the camera. And it's so easy when you're looking at other people's lives to not see all the good things in your own life and not appreciate your own life because you're comparing it to them, right? Because you're like, oh, like I live in this amazing place. And it's like, well, look where Maureen is. Like, she's out in the sun, you know, like, and then, but there's always someone on Instagram in a cooler place than you. And then you forget to look outside and be like, but it's actually pretty cool here as well, you know? So I think it would be that, the Look Again book and like appreciating what you have. You live in heaven. It's beautiful.
I know. And do you know what? I've been doing similar. I was reading a book as well. And I do my gratitude anyway in my journal. But I'm really focusing on really now looking at the positives of every day, because you can forget about all those little things that make you so happy where you live are. So I'm now trying to, it sounds a bit like woo-woo, doesn't it? But it makes a real difference. Just literally like listing out like all of the things I've loved about the day, no matter how small they are. And then you suddenly start just being a little bit more content with everything anyway. Because it can be easy to go, oh, but when I can do that, that's going to be better. And when I'm finally there and actually got it pretty good. So
yeah, and as soon as you get there, you'll have already set a goal for the next thing, right? And you never actually appreciate where you've got. Whereas if you kind of like take your mind back to yourself a year ago or 5 years ago, or even like Maureen as she was like leaving her job, you know, you'd be like, okay, this is where you're going to be in 5 years and 3 years, whatever it was. you'd be like, that's absolutely incredible, I'm so happy. But now you're like, oh, but I want that bit more, which I don't think is necessarily a bad thing, because it keeps you striving for more. But you want to like create the balance of, I want to push myself, I want to strive for more, but I also look how far I've come, you know, like, and it's not a one or other thing, which I think is definitely something I used to kind of think, similar to kind of perfectionist and like tendencies, like if I don't hold myself to these unrealistic standards, if I'm not always pushing myself for more and never really appreciating what I have, then that if I appreciate what I have, I'll just get lazy. Like it's a stupid narrative, but like I think underlying there's a lot of it for most people of like, well, then I'll just get complacent if I'm happy with where I am. It's like, no, you can be happy where you are and strive for more.
I think almost when you're in a calmer state of mind and more content state of mind, more happens anyway. Like you can be more open to more because you're not constantly like looking and wondering what you can be doing. So you actually could end up getting those things faster. Who knows?
Oh no, 100%. So the book, The Happiness Advantage, another book that had a huge impact on me, it kind of states that it's like most people see this correlation between success and happiness, and they think that that person's happier because they're successful, when actually it was the happiness that drove the success. Like happier people go for more opportunities, they attract more people, they, you know, part of the reason people want to be part of Commit to Six is because we all have a laugh, like we're having a good time, like that's actually, you know, it's not very tangible, it's probably not why people say that they come, but part of it's that, like we were always like downers and really negative about everything, like people probably wouldn't want to be coached by us, they wouldn't want to be around us. And it's not something, yeah, that you kind of identify, but often it is like happier people are more successful because they're more likely to go for those opportunities, because they're more resilient as well. Like, you know, one bad thing happens, they don't let it ruin their whole day. They're like, okay, but broadly, things are good. And, you know, I practice gratitude and, you know, I can also think about, will this matter in a year? Like, how much brain energy am I giving to this? When in a month, I won't even remember that it's happened, you know? Yeah.
Gosh, we got deep.
Oh, I know.
Somebody else commented that their piece of advice to their younger self, so I can share that if you like.
Yeah.
So, you're not fat. You're a perfectly average teenager. Stick with the sport and just eat when you're hungry. And I think a lot will probably be able to relate to that.
Mm-hmm.
There we go. Next question. Does anyone else feel nervous before a workout / going to the gym? It's sort of a butterflies in the tummy before you start. And then once you started, it just goes. I've been working out for 15 plus years and I still get it.
Oh, I think that's a good thing. Probably means you're pushing yourself as well. Like I honestly, I don't get that before a workout, but I used to get it when I was rowing or when I did athletics or something, like before a session, I'd be a bit scared, which I don't think is a bad thing, but I would get like a little bit nervous and I'd be like, oh God, I'm really going to have to push myself. Like, and that, like knowing that it's going to hurt a bit, like it probably shows that I don't push myself that much anymore.
I said the same in her check-in. I said, this is, I only get that if I know I've got a hard finisher coming up, or if I'm going on a hard run, or I'm challenging myself in that way. So yeah.
But it could be excitement, like nervousness and excitement will feel the same in the body.
Yeah.
So it might be that you're just really excited to do your workout every time.
Yeah, but okay. So yeah. Although I would say I definitely wasn't excited about doing those sessions. It was definitely like a bit of a fear. Like a nervous fear.
Hmm.
That's what I took from that. And that's what I feel the times that I feel that kind of butterfly, that, and like, I'm already thinking sometimes when I'm doing the strength element and I'm like, I've got that road to do at the end and it's going to be really hard. And often I'm telling myself that it's okay, Ruth, just don't worry. Just, if you need to take it easy, you can take it easy. And you never do. But in your head, you're giving yourself all these permissions before you get there. So I took it as that, but it could be that she's really excited.
Yeah.
Just take it as that and just roll with it. Yeah. Yes, deadlifts.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. Hi, my first podcast question after listening for so long. Very exciting. When tracking, would you go by the cows on the packet or weigh everything yourself? So, for example, if you have a 300 gram pack of chicken with two chicken breasts and one is bigger, would you just track it as 150 grams each and assume your calories will even out when you eat the smaller one? Or would you weigh each chicken breast separately? Thanks.
When I'm tracking, I'm the person who, if I was making it just 1 meal at a time, I'd be weighing it out. Yeah. But like, it will just balance itself out.
I don't think it really matters. Like, if you do want to weigh it out, fine. Like, I definitely wouldn't, because touching raw chicken breast is the...
Yeah, you don't touch it. You use a fork and a knife.
Oh, even that, though.
No, I see people like on Instagram doing those food videos and they're like just picking up the chicken and throwing it into the bowl and mixing it with the seasoning. And I'm like, what are you doing?
I would do that.
You do?
Yes.
Oh no, I can't cope with the feel of stuff. I'm like, I have to wash my hands. It's just, yeah, no. I get it. I put a fork into the chicken breast in the packet. I'd take it out on the chopping board. I'd weigh it. If something needed to come off, I'd cut it with a knife. There'd be no fucking touching it with my hand.
Yeah. I think the point that you're making in this question, though, which is quite good, is like, realistically, if you're going to eat both of them and in one meal, you know, you've had slightly more calories and in the next meal you've had slightly less, like, it's quite a good example of just, you know, because one night you might have the bigger chicken breast and you will have had slightly more calories, but then you're going to even out the next night, right? And it's a good example of just like how calories should kind of work anyway. Like, don't stress out that you're going to have a couple of calories more because the chicken breast is bigger, because the next night it's going to be a couple of calories less because it's smaller. Like, I wouldn't worry about that at all. If, for example, like one was significantly bigger and like you're eating one and your partner's eating one, I still wouldn't weigh it, but I might be like, okay, that's obviously a bit bigger. It's probably closer to 180 grams instead of 150 grams. And maybe calculate it that way. You could be nice and be like, I'm on a fat loss diet. You can have the bigger chicken breast.
I would definitely be taking some of the other ones to make them even.
But they'd be like, what happened to the side of my breast? Chicken breast? Oh, sorry about that. Yeah, it just looks slightly bigger. So I just thought... Life a little bit.
In my Fitness Pal and NutriCheck, you know, if you're searching for a medium-sized chicken breast and so on, there's going to be an average kind of calories there. I don't think I've ever weighed a chicken breast particularly. I've just looked at it, like Emma said, and gone small, medium, large. That's a hefty one or whatever. But and I do that with a lot. I, when I'm tracking, which I don't at the moment, but I would do that with a lot of things and then go for an upper estimate if I'm guessing, going for a kind of higher one, I guess.
There is, and this isn't to make people like over analytical about stuff, but there are so many inaccuracies here. Like, you'll find that cheaper chicken breasts, when you cook them, get real small, because there's so much like water, I think it's like water pumped into it. Whereas like other chicken breasts, that doesn't really happen. So, you know, technically there's probably more calories in that than when you weighed the other one that had more water in. Obviously water doesn't have calories, but it also weigh more. So that, and little things like that, like, again, that doesn't mean like dehydrate your chicken breast first, but it is just like another example of where inaccuracies can come in.
Yeah, but just on that, like, I'm not saying to be over analytical, but I do think for some people, they will hear that of us saying, you know, oh, eyeball. And some people, like, you need to stop eyeballing. Mm-hmm. And you need to weigh your fucking chicken breast, because, like, just no concept or no education around food portioning. I just don't think that it would be helpful to say for everyone to eyeball. Definitely. After a while of learning what like portion sizes look like and stuff, absolutely. But if you're somebody who has no concept of portion sizes or anything like that, I would be saying do a spell of weighing your food but actually paying attention to what you're weighing and being like, okay, this is X amount of grams. That's what that looks like. I can recognize that again for the future, rather than just on a whim thinking, oh, surely that's 180 grams of chicken and it could be like 250.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think it's a good educational tool. And I really like the point of weigh it, look at what it looks like on a plate, in a bowl, you know, cooked it, so that you know that next time you, I don't know, you're at your mates and they make you a chicken breast, you're like, okay, that looks roughly like the chicken breast I have, which I know is roughly blah, blah, blah. And then you can eyeball it. I really like the analogy of this, of using a sat nav, because it's the same kind of thing, right? If you use the sat nav, but you don't really, you literally just follow it, you don't really pay attention to your surroundings, or, oh, I turned right after that shop or whatever, you will consistently have to use the sat nav to get somewhere. Whereas if you're kind of aware of where you're going as you're using the sat nav, you don't need it anymore. Like after a couple of times, you're like, oh, I don't need this. I know where I'm going now. So I would think about that with the same, like when you're weighing, do it for a couple of days or do it for a week and be really, you know, weigh everything out. It's so eye-opening. Like even now, if I ever do it like for a day or something, I'm like, didn't think it was that much. It's so easy for things to creep in as well. And then the other approach that you can take is kind of starting with eyeballing. And if you get results, you never need to get any more analytical about things. But if you're like, huh, I thought I was eating 1600 calories, but I'm not losing weight, and that really should be a deficit for me. Okay, then let's get really analytical and let's see how much olive oil you're putting on. Let's see how big that chicken breast is. Let's see where things are creeping in. Because I can guarantee you every single time I do this with a client, there's something. They're like, oh my God, mayo. Didn't realize that was adding 100 calories and I have it in 3 meals a day. And I'm like, well, there you go. Like, that's basically your deficit.
It's like a teaspoon of honey. Like I put honey on my yogurt, but now I've got the squeezy thing, like honey, and it's not a teaspoon. It's just no way.
No, it's not, Ruth. But then again, it's like, okay, well, you don't need to do that anymore because you're not in fat loss. But if you were like, right, okay, I need to tighten stuff up, then what would you change? Yeah, you'd probably be like, okay, I'm probably going to stop being quite so generous with the squeezy honey.
Yeah, it needs to it probably should happen anyway because it's just no need.
Good taste, nice though.
That's the need.
That's the need, exactly. Yeah,
that's the need. I'm not worried about it, but if, like you said, things can get bigger over time if you start relaxing a little bit, and so you might, it would be like, it worked before and now it's not working. It's those types of things. The teaspoon of honey is now a big splurge, and then throughout the day it adds up to quite a lot, doesn't it?
I think the other thing to think about as well is, if I guess if you're feeling a little bit overwhelmed by the changes, I can guarantee you can look at what you're eating at the moment and make swaps. Like whether that's, okay, normally I'd have a sandwich at lunchtime, but now I'm going to make it with those little thin slices of bread instead of normal bread. Okay, you've saved 100 calories. And now I'm going to use light mayo instead of full fat. You've saved another 100 calories. At breakfast, instead of having a glass of orange juice, I'm going to have an orange and a glass of water. You've saved another 100 calories. Like sometimes the changes are really quite simple, and it doesn't have to be this huge overhaul of your diet. And before you know it, like, you know, you've created an easy 400-500 calorie deficit for the day by just making swaps around what you're already doing. So yeah, try that.
I've been reading about set point theory and I'm uncertain about whether it's true or not. What does the latest evidence suggest? And most importantly, does it really matter? Maureen, that came from you.
Most importantly, does it really matter? There is a set point that your body will gravitate towards, but it's more to do with your behaviors and the corresponding weight that you will be at around those behaviors, right? And there is also truth in that if you try and get leaner and lose body fat, your body kind of pushes back, right? So via increased hunger and reduced activity levels. Some people say that that's because it's protecting its set point. It's more that it's just like what happens when you get in a deficit, right? And your body is more heavily predisposed to avoid starvation than it is to avoid obesity, right? So you're always going to be driven to eat probably more than what you need. And when you start reducing calories, your body's going to be like, oh no, we don't really like that. Like, let's make you a bit more hungry. You know, that's just like a normal response. I wouldn't say it's set point theory as such. The reason that I think people resonate with it so much is that there will normally be a weight that you gravitate around, and then to go below that, you'll have to change something a bit more, right? So you might be like, no, I think my set point's like 65 kilograms. I always get to about there, and then it seems really hard. And it's like, yeah, because, you know, the basic changes which got you to that point aren't going to get you further, right? So then you need to walk a little bit more or eat a little bit less to continue to lose fat.
Yeah, I think you can look at it as like your comfort zone, like rather than like a set point. It's like, this is where you're comfortable at. This is where you can maintain these habits and behaviors comfortably, and that your body weight that you fall at is a result of that. So it's like anything. If you're comfortable at doing one thing and then you have to change something that makes you feel uncomfortable, it's going to be hard, and you're going to want to gravitate back into your comfort zone. So I think that's a good way to kind of look at it and be like, okay, I'm comfortable here at this given weight doing these things. If I want to change that, I'm going to have to be a bit uncomfortable, and that might be a bit hard, and I might want to keep coming back to my comfort zone. But it's not a case of you can't change where your comfort zone is. You can always change it, but that part of you will always kind of, obviously there is physiological things that's driving it, but in simple terms, if you can kind of think about, okay, this is where I'm comfortable, and to change it will make me a bit uncomfortable.
I think that's a great analogy.
Thank you. I just came up with that myself.
It's quite a nice way of getting to maintenance. I kind of think that's what over the time has happened with me for sure, is that I could push and get leaner. And I know I could probably quite easily just by changing a few things, but I'm having a really nice balance at the moment with life and family and things. And it's working. And you get to that point where you're like, actually at the moment, this is where I'm happy to be. And it's not because my body won't go any smaller, you know, I can't get smaller. It's just that this is the place where if I was to change something, it's going to impact something else, which is yeah, fine sometimes, but I just don't want it to impact those other things at the moment.
Yeah, I guess you could see it, and that is like the balancing point of, I have really nice life balance at the moment. Okay, I have just realized that I'm meant to be on the EIQ live now, so goodbye everyone. Thank you for the excellent questions. Thank you, Mo, for your brains. And if you're interested in finding out more about Commit 6, head over to esgfitness.co.uk/commit6. That's all. Goodbye.
Bye.